In the summer of 1915, when he was just turning 29 years of age, George Pepperdine got on a train in Denver, Colorado, and came to California for the first time in his life. He arrived in San Francisco, saw the city, attended a convention, got on a train and worked his way down through the length of the great state, all the way down to San Diego. He liked what he saw. He was suffering from some mild bad health, and his physicians had urged him to consider perhaps a move to California. It might improve his health. He liked what he saw, went home to his wife, Lena, and made the decision to move. February 1916. What a historic moment when George Pepperdine came into Los Angeles for the first time. He was already well on his way to becoming one of the great businessmen in the history of this land. His Western Auto Company, which had been founded in Kansas City and spread to Denver, was on the brink of its greatest years. He walked down Automobile Row on Main Street looking for a little empty store somewhere that perhaps he could rent that would be the beginning place, the birth of his West Coast operation. When he came to 12th and Main, he saw the store. He went in, looked around it. It didn't look like much, but he had great dreams. The price was right. He rented it, and the dream was begun on the West Coast. Next month, March the 20th, 1916, the store opened. This was to be George Pepperdine's home for the last 46 years of his life. And from that beginning in 1916 in Los Angeles, through the rest of that decade and on through the 20s, store after store were launched in community after community until he had 200 Western Auto stores out here in the West and a partnership and 178 stores on the other side of the Mississippi. His fortune grew as he became a multimillionaire, and he began to think in terms of what he might do with his wealth, how he could best help humanity. When did he get the dream to start a Christian college? Historians are divided. Almost everyone thinks it was somewhere around 1935. But for me, I think it was earlier. I think it perhaps was late in 1927 when he took his two daughters, Florence and Esther, on a trip, and they went to Honolulu, and then they went further to Japan and to China and to the Philippines. And he met some of the missionaries out there and found that to a person, the missionaries had been trained at Christian colleges. He sat down in Japan with Harry Robert Fox, Sr. He went over to China, and in the city of Canton, he met a young missionary named George Benson, who was from Harding. And in his long conversations with these men, he began to see the importance of a Christian college education. He had never attended college, much less a Christian college. The following year, in 1928, he took his widowed mother around the world, something he'd wanted to do for so long, and he'd been so busy in his company, but finally he carved out the necessary months, and in 1928, when he was 41 years old, off they went to England and Holland and Germany and Switzerland and Italy and Palestine and India and China and Japan and Hawaii and home. They were gone for months. And every place he went, he met with the missionaries. And to a man, they had been trained at a Christian college. I am persuaded that his long conversation with George Benson in Canton, China, and his long conversation with Harry Robert Fox, Sr. in Japan, as early as 1927-28, 10 years before he started the school, was perhaps the first germ of an idea. His wife died in 1930. It was a great loss. 4.5 years later, he married Helen Davis. Helen Davis was to be his partner for the rest of his life and was with us today as we celebrated 50 years of this school. The day the school started, 50 years ago today, on September 21, 1937, two ministers were up there on that platform. His own minister, T.W. Phillips of the Southwest Church, who's with us in this audience right now, and the great G.C. Brewer, long since dead now, but who is the minister of the Central Church of Christ in Los Angeles. Those two men had helped to encourage him to give his fortune to the founding of a Christian college. He had traveled back to look at other colleges. He went to Harding and met with George Benson and J.N. Armstrong. He went to Freed Hardeman. He went to Nashville and met with a variety of the businessmen there, including A.M. Burton, who was the founder of the Life and Casualty Insurance Company, who had given his fortune to that school. He came back to California. He still wasn't sure. And then in the dead of winter of 1936-37, he made a long-distance phone call in a day when long-distance phone calls were rare and an extreme luxury. He called George Benson, his old friend, because Benson had now come back from Canton, China, and had been made the new president of Harding College in Searcy, Arkansas. He called him and said, "I've got to talk to you. I'm making a decision that affects my fortune. It affects the rest of my life. I don't want to talk to you on the phone. I want to see you face to face. Benson said in a correspondence with me a couple of years ago that he got in his old Plymouth and he started driving from Searcy, Arkansas, and he hardly stopped. He ran into a snowstorm in Flagstaff, Arizona, only got 4 hours sleep that night, but he kept churning all the way across the country, came into George Pepperdine's office and had that great meeting with him as they talked about what to do. George Benson recommended as the first president of such a school Batzel Baxter, who was president of David Lipscomb College, and Hugh Tyner, who did as much as any one person to influence George Pepperdine to start the school, also recommended Batzel Baxter. And so the message went out to Nashville, can you come? And Mr. Baxter came to meet with George Pepperdine. The date, February 1937. The lights were on pretty late that night on West Adams Boulevard in the George Pepperdine home. They dreamed big dreams. They talked of what it would take to build a 4-year school, to start it immediately. And the decision was made late that night, on into the wee hours of the morning. Yes, we will do it. Not only will we do it, but we'll start it this September. The very next day, they went out and began looking for sites. They didn't find one for a few weeks. They finally found the old Connolly estate. It had been vacant for 3 years, had an 18-room mansion on it, beautiful 34-acre spot. It was bordering on Vermont Avenue, and when you came in off Vermont Avenue, there were palm trees that lined the promenade all the way to the mansion. They began to dream that the mansion could be the president's home, and the promenade could be where the students walked to school, and dormitories could go here, and the administration building there, and the library there, and the gymnasium over there, and the track beyond, and this would be the center of the campus, and the dream began to unfold. And 50 years ago today, September 21, 1937, the school was launched. George Pepperdine stood up on that historic occasion to thunderous applause from 2,000 people who came to see what it was all about. He gave a very brief address. It opened with these famous lines: what we say here today in the dedication of these buildings is of very little importance, but the work which will be done through the days and years and generations to come will be of very great importance, if that work is guided by the hand of God. What I mean by the statement, guided by the hand of God, is that God's Spirit, working through His holy word, the Bible, shall influence and control the lives of each and every member of the faculty to such an extent that He will spread Christian influence among the students. The board was selected: George Pepperdine, Hugh Tyner, Clarence Shattuck, A.J. Dumb, Don Miller, a 5-member board. Time magazine had sent out the word in its June 14th issue that the school was coming. And when it began that year, no one thought that the success would be as immediate. But the president, Batzel Baxter, went up to Spokane, Washington on April the 6th, 1938, to plead the case before the Northwest Association of Schools and Colleges, the major accrediting agency, and the school passed. Full accreditation in less than 7 months. No school of the 3,000 colleges and universities in America, no school had ever accomplished it in quite so quick a time. This was to be a special school indeed. On June the 6th, at the end of that first year, 1938, the first graduating class, only 4 students who had transferred to Pepperdine as juniors and gone 1 year, Paul Tucker and Carmen Landrum from David Lipscomb College, Malcolm Hinckley from Harding and Richard Gibson from Abilene Christian, graduated while E.H. Imes, the president of David Lipscomb College, gave the address. Baxter served only 2 years as president. That's what he had promised. And when he stepped aside, George Pepperdine looked around to think who would lead this school. And his eyes came to rest on his young dean, 31 years old, Hugh Tyner, and he named him president, the youngest college president in America, on April the 13th, 1939. This school was moving fast, and it was to be a school for young people and even young administrators. That spring, the school suddenly burst onto the sports map when 4 boys who made up the 2-mile relay team went to Drake University, Des Moines, Iowa, to compete in the world-famous Drake Relays. And surprise of surprises, they won. Their names became legendary in the annals of the Hall of Fame at Pepperdine: Jack Russell, Froggy Lavorne, Stanley Summers, Wally Simpson. they ran for all they were worth. And the announcer who was up in the booth calling the race, his name was Ronald Reagan. One day he would become president of the United States. In the school year of 1940-41, they wanted something in the center of the campus, and somebody bought an inexpensive little cherub that they named Dolores and put her there at the fountain. She didn't cost much, and she was only about 2 feet high, but Dolores became the sweetheart of the campus, and she reigned from that pedestal until the school moved to Malibu, and then she was moved here with the school. In 1939, at Thanksgiving, when the school was into its second year, over at Arkansas, Harding College was having a tough time. Maybe it was going to close its doors. It needed money. George and Helen Pepperdine sat down and tried to determine what they ought to do. They needed every penny they could get to keep their school going. The lengthening shadow of the Depression was still everywhere. But still, they ought to be generous to others. And in what I personally think was one of the great moments in the history of this school, George and Helen sat down at their home one night and wrote a check for $25,000, which in today's dollars is a little in excess of $250,000, to help another college in another state when their own school could have used the money. The motto was a reality there. Freely you have received, freely give. There was an event that took place on the lawn of the president's home, June 16, 1941, at the end of the fourth year of the school, that I think was symbolic of what was happening all through those years and is still happening on this campus, a wedding. People came to Pepperdine and fell in love. There was a co-ed from Hollywood, sort of wandered into school. Her name was Gloria Millay. It was a local community school, so she attended. But on that day, she wed the bachelor dean, J.P. Sanders. He wasn't dean yet. He was chairman of the Bible department. They went back to David Lipscomb College, but the day would come when he would return and be the dean here from 1957 to 1972. In the fall of 1941, the Beachcombers, a boys' social club, decided they would have their annual banquet in the famous Coconut Grove of the Ambassador Hotel. What a great evening. I've got a photo in my book. The girls look so pretty in their formals, and the boys look so handsome, and so much of the future seemed bright. But in just a few days after that photo, the bombing of Pearl Harbor changed all of their lives, and the war struck with sudden fury and sudden urgency. 23 boys spent their last chapel service in 1942, and with everybody weeping, walked out onto the administration lawn, and the bus came and took them to Fort MacArthur. The war was here. It had come to Pepperdine. 350 boys eventually served in the war. The coach at Pepperdine, old Coach Duer, put out a magazine called On the Beam, and he sent it to all the boys wherever they went, and he kept in touch with them all through the war years. And when the war was over, and they had homecoming in 1946, they all signed letters written to Coach Duer, presented it in a leather-bound volume, and handed it to him and said, "Thank you, Coach," at the 1946 homecoming. Well, not all of them. In September 1944, the news hit campus with a shock. The first of the Pepperdine boys had been killed. June Tuggle, he'd been on the basketball team, joined the U.S. Marines, killed at Guam in September 1944. And then Robert Carter, and then Hugh McCullough, and then Bruce Mundy, and Jack Slade, Charles Stivers. Six boys gave their life during the war. During the war years, Pepperdine became famous as a basketball power in Los Angeles. In 1942-43, the team went 26-9, and when they played USC, even though USC had a winning streak of 15 games, Pepperdine beat them, led by All-Americans Gordy Wells and Lowry Ruby. The next year, they were 22-13, and in 1944-45, 24-12, and they beat UCLA. In 45-46, they were 28-8, and they beat UCLA again. Nick Buzelitz was a two-time All-American. The men's tennis team won the small college doubles championship at 45 and won the national team championship in 52. During those years, a variety of famous people came to the campus. Rabbi Edgar Magnin spoke in chapel in April 1941 and told the students about the tragedy of Adolf Hitler. J. Edgar Goodspeed, the great Bible translator, and Byron Nelson, the most famous golfer of the day who was a member of the Church of Christ, came to speak in chapel. The governor of California, Earl Warren, spoke in graduation in 1948. Charles Laughton, the famous actor, came to campus in 1950 and gave his dramatic readings. Senator Estes Kefauver, who was running for the presidency of the United States, came in 1951. Will Durant, the great historian, in 55, and Chet Huntley of the news fame came in 1956. And the students themselves were now graduating and branching off into different areas of life. Gordy Hahn ran for and won a seat in the California State Legislature before he graduated from Pepperdine. One of the youngest, in fact, he was the youngest state legislator in the history of the state of California. Along came his brother, Kenneth Hahn, and he began his political career with Pepperdine students knocking doors for him. And he elevated himself to the point where, in December 1, 1952, he was sworn in as a member of the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, a position he has held for 35 years and still maintains to this day. When the war was over, a number of Pepperdine students said, "We must go to our enemies, and we must feed them. We must clothe them, and we must take them the gospel of Jesus Christ." And so two Pepperdine boys decided to preach in the footsteps of Hitler. They got in 1946, Otis Gatewood and Roy Palmer. Their lives were exciting and daring, and churches began to flourish in Germany as they went from town to town preaching the gospel based on the training they had received at Pepperdine. Four young men decided that instead of Germany, they would go to war-torn Italy. Carl Mitchell, Mel Pownall, Howard Bybee, Harold Payton. They went and gave their lives, many years of their lives. When the war was over, Pepperdine looked around and saw some war surplus buildings on the western edge of the campus and bought them for married student housing. 92 units. They weren't much. Each apartment was two rooms. One room was a kitchen, living room, and dining room combined. And the other was the sort of the bedroom, bathroom unit back here. They rented for $32 a month. But for many young married couples, it was paradise. Pepperdine finally had married student housing. I think of Hale Hawes and Joanne Penn, who were married on September 5, 1946, and moved into their first little home at Normandy Village. They recently celebrated their 41st wedding anniversary. The school grew dramatically when the war was over. The school that 2 years before had 500 students and then 800 now had 1,426, and a new sport on campus, football. Pepperdine went to football in September 46. No one could imagine the success they were going to have. In the first two seasons, they won 17 out of 18 games. The only game they lost in the first 2 years was the game at Arizona State, 13-12. But the next year when the Sun Devils came to Los Angeles, Pepperdine won 27-6. The touchdown twins, Darwin Horn, who was honored in chapel this morning, and Terry Bell, helped Pepperdine lead the nation in scoring. And when, at the end of the first season, they were invited to play in the inaugural Will Rogers Bowl in Oklahoma City, it was a tremendous thrill. They went up against Nebraska Wesleyan, and they were losing in the cold, 7-0 at halftime. Must have been some halftime speech. When the second half started, Darwin Horn scored, and then Bell, and then Horn again. And when the dust cleared, Pepperdine had won 38-13 and claimed the small college national football championship. The first students to graduate in the MA program graduated in graduation of 1947. The Bible lectureship had started back in January 1943, the MA program in Bible in September 1944, and now on June the 1st, 1947, five young men came to receive their MA in Bible. Their names, Weldon Bennett, who went on to a long career at Abilene Christian College as a Bible faculty member, Lloyd Ellis, who gave his life to preaching in California, Roy Key, who became a gospel preacher, Roy Palmer, who went to Germany to do missionary work, and L.D. Webb, who became a great Christian educator and helped found Columbia Christian College. Those were the first five that came across the stage to get their diplomas. On April the 26th, 1947, Pepperdine University, or George Pepperdine College as it was then, sent a mile relay team to the famous Drake Relays again. They not only won, they not only beat the other 29 teams in competition, but their time of 3 minutes, 17.9 seconds was the fastest time in the nation that year. Their names were Terry Bell and George Edson, Bob Valerio, and Sam Travis. And the drama program was doing well. Kind Lady was the fall production in 1947, It only ran for 2 nights in the 1,000-seat auditorium on the old campus, but it drew 2,000 people. That's as many as it could have drawn. And 3 years later, when The Merchant of Venice was the fall production, on November 7th when it opened, there were searchlights across the sky because Pepperdine was having a premiere of its new theatrical production. It even made the television news, and they took out ads on television. Throughout the years at the old campus, there was a beautiful custom. George and Helen Pepperdine prepared dinner for the graduates every year in June. Not just for the graduates, but for their parents. It was on the lawn of the Pepperdine home at West Adams. Helen did all the cooking. George did the serving. Those who have been at those dinners and have told me about it, what kind of school is this? Where else could you find the founder and his wife honoring the graduates by preparing them dinner? The dinner that took place on June 3, 1950 was typical of what was going on in those years. And the alumni was growing. They moved into their house on 78th Street. The alumni house was dedicated on May the 29th, 1954. And then Pepperdine started a new tradition, the Spring Musical. It started in 1955 with The Merry Widow, went through 4 performances, and it was a sellout. The next year they came back with Carousel. 3,000 people came to see Carousel. The Spring Musical was here at Pepperdine. It would never again leave. In 1956, in the Olympic Games, Pepperdine had her first, but certainly not her last, performer in the Olympic Games. He was a track star, Jerome Walters, and he performed in the 1,500-meter race. The Associated Women of Pepperdine launched their great career in 1958, a year after Norval Young had come to be the third president of the college. His wife, Helen Young, launched this group of women who, through the years, have raised money for scholarships. They've raised well over $1 million. They've become the living endowment, and next summer they celebrate their 30th anniversary. George Pepperdine was selected by the students to be their graduation speaker in 1957, the only time he ever spoke in graduation. He spoke on a vision and a challenge. And some of the alumni said, the school's going to be 21 years old pretty soon. It's come of age. In the fall of 1958, let's put out a film. And they got together, they bought some film, they didn't know what they were doing. They wrote a script, and they put out a 35-minute film that was a classic that we still have around here on video cassette that all of you ought to see sometime. It was put out by 2 alums called Dick Melvett and Joe Orlando. Ken Ross, another alum, wrote the script, and many of the students acted in the roles. And for 35 minutes, they told the story of what George Pepperdine College was like in 1958. In 1961, on May the 13th, a dinner was held in the Statler Hilton Hotel. It was a month before the 75th anniversary of the birth of George Pepperdine, and it was the big alumni night. And that night, they honored George Pepperdine on his 75th birthday. The city of Los Angeles came that night in the person of their representatives and gave him a gold medallion and called him the Citizen of the Year in Los Angeles for 1961. A telegram arrived in the middle of the dinner from the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy, in which he praised Mr. Pepperdine for having the courage to give away his money for a cause that was greater than himself, namely Christian education. And the Freedoms Foundation at Valley Forge gave Pepperdine College its highest honor, the Thomas Jefferson Medal, that year in 61, for its citizenship program. The Bible lectureship was getting bigger every year, and in March 22, 1962, 11,000 people showed up at the Los Angeles Sports Arena for the opening night of the Bible lectureship. George Pepperdine was the surprise guest that night. He was so ill, no one thought he could come, but an ambulance drove inside dramatically into the LA Sports Arena. They brought him out on a stretcher. They brought him to the microphone. And he spoke to his people for the last time. He died 4 months later. But it was his last public address to 11,000 at the Bible lectureship. He told them how proud he was of the school. It was all that he had ever wanted it to be. He was so pleased that he had lived to see it through the first 25 years. He couldn't begin to imagine what it would be like at the age of 50. The next fall, Norval Young announced on November 2, 1962, Pepperdine is going international. We're going to start a Year in Europe program. He went to the faculty and he said, is there anybody here that would like to teach in the Year in Europe program? And the first hand that went up was a history professor named Howard White. It not only went up the first, but it went up the highest. And he said, I'll let you do it if you can get 15 students. Won't be easy. talking these kids into going off to live in Germany, but he didn't get 15 students, he got 36. And on September 5, 1963, they boarded an American Airlines plane, J.C. Moore and his family and Howard White and his family, and flew to Heidelberg, West Germany, which was to become the center of Pepperdine's Year in Europe program. 2 years later, they found a mansion, four stories high, that would sleep 56 students as well as the faculty family, and they bought it. And when J.C. Moore died in 1969, they named it in memory of him, called it Moore House. I like what happened in 1965. America was criticizing the boys who were fighting in Vietnam. It was tough to be in Vietnam, to be young and to be that far from home, and to be the butt of so many jokes and so much criticism, but not at Pepperdine. The students there decided, let's honor those young men. They don't want to be there, but they're doing what they've been asked to do. They said, let's send them packages of food and candy, and they began to gather food. The whole student body got behind it. It was called Operation Thanks, to say thanks to the boys in service. NBC picked it up, and then CBS and ABC, and Pepperdine got a lot of fame over that. 12,000 pounds of food gathered by the Pepperdine students, all packaged by Pepperdine students, sealed up and stamped and sent on its way to soldiers serving in Vietnam. It was during those years when the school needed money desperately to keep going that a man died and left in his will $1 million to Pepperdine. We had never had a gift anywhere near that amount. The largest gift had been $198,000 from the Ford Foundation years before for faculty salaries. $1 million? But there was a catch. You have to honor a certain person with an honorary doctorate. Well, it wasn't that that person wasn't worthy of the doctorate. It was the principle of the thing. We should not accept money with strings attached to it. And so Pepperdine made the decision, no, we will not accept the gift, not with strings attached. We got more fame out of that than we would have ever gotten by accepting it. More money came in from people who said, that's the kind of school, the kind of ethics, the kind of stand all of our schools ought to be. And the theater program continued to grow during the 60s. In 1963, the fall production was Oklahoma. And even though it was supposed to open the day Kennedy was assassinated, and a pall fell on the campus, when it finally did open, it played to sell-out crowds for four straight nights. 4,000 people, four nights. And the next year, when they did My Fair Lady, 4,500 in five nights. There was a singing group formed called the Corollaires. Five young boys, five young girls, students at Pepperdine, who took their musical instruments and began to sing in different places. The USO heard about them and said, come sing to the troops. And in January of 1965, they left on a nine-week USO tour that took them to Okinawa, the Philippines, Taiwan, Guam, Korea, Iwo Jima, Japan, entertaining the U.S. troops. It was, I think, a great moment in the history of Pepperdine. By 1966, it was obvious that Pepperdine was running out of room on the old campus. Dr. Young announced that he was forming a committee to fan out across Southern California and find a place where Pepperdine could expand to. And then in 1968, the announcement came. It was electrifying, October 7, 1968. The Adamson-Ringe family of Malibu, California, was going to give, absolutely free, a multi-million dollar gift of 138 prime acres at the corner of Pacific Coast Highway and Malibu Canyon Road. And the dream was launched, the miracle of Malibu. A new singing group started in 1968. They also had 10 voices, 6 boys, 4 girls. They called themselves the Singin' Travelers. And they went out across America to be the representatives of Pepperdine. In 1968, they toured through 16 states recruiting students from Pepperdine. That fall, one of the leading contenders for the presidency of the United States, Hubert H. Humphrey, came to the Pepperdine campus and spent the day, spoke to the students, had lunch on the campus, September 25, 1968. By the summer of 1969, Pepperdine had been given a law school, the Orange College of Law, which today is the Pepperdine Law School on this campus. On February the 9th, 1970, the dinner that we have come to call the birth of a college took place. So many people wanted to come to the dinner at the Century Plaza Hotel that the university, in a spur of the moment, had to book a second hotel nearby, the Beverly Hilton. 3,400 people came to the dinners. Both of the ballrooms were overflowing, and the governor of California, Ronald Reagan, spoke at both dinners. The dinners were simultaneous, and he went to one and spoke, and they raced him down to the next, and he spoke at that. 3,400 people had come to hear the dream about building a campus at Malibu. A major guest that night was the architect, William Pereira, and he unveiled his plans and showed the drawings of what the campus would look like. Just 3 months later, on May the 23rd, 1970, they came out to this campus for the first time and dedicated the site. The hill had been shaved off. That was about all. No buildings were under construction. But they came out and made William S. Banowski the founding chancellor. And on that day, May 23rd, 1970, he gave his great speech, "The Spirit of Place." They announced university status then, and Pepperdine College became Pepperdine University on January the 1st, 1971. Construction began on April the 13th, 1971, and on September 6, 1972, 916 students walked onto this campus for the first time. There was no running water, certainly no hot water. The buildings weren't quite ready. It was like going to camp, but the Malibu miracle had begun. That spring in 1973, in Elkins Auditorium, Songfest started for the first time, now into its 14th year. In 1975, Ronald Reagan came to speak at the dedication of Seaver College on April 20th. Betty Ford, the First Lady of the land, came to honor the 10th anniversary of Pepperdine's foster grandparents program. And then, in the biggest event this campus had seen to date, President Gerald R. Ford, the 38th President of the United States, came to this campus on September 20, 1975, to dedicate the Brock House and the Firestone Field House. A crowd in excess of 18,000 people showed up for the event. In 1976, what was the great event? You just have to look at the yearbook. It's on the cover, a basketball game, the greatest game in the history of the school. The University of Nevada at Las Vegas was undefeated. They were 20-0. They were awesome. They were ranked third in the nation. They had beaten Pepperdine by 17 points 2 weeks before in Las Vegas. Pepperdine had a good team, but they were 14-5, and they had lost 3 games in a row. They were reeling. And then that night, the Running Rebels came to Firestone Fieldhouse. And in the most dramatic game ever played here, before the biggest crowd in the history of Firestone Fieldhouse, 4,500, still the largest crowd ever to be in that fieldhouse for a sporting event, on February the 6th, 1976, led by Ollie Mattson and Marcos Leyte, and especially Dennis Johnson, the Waves won 93-91. It was a stunning accomplishment to knock off the number 3 team in the land. A few months later, a member of the United States Supreme Court, Harry Blackmun, came to this campus to dedicate the site of the Odell McConnell Law Center that was just getting ready to begin construction. In 1977, the founding 400 of the Pepperdine Associates began. They had their first dinner on February the 9th, and Nobel laureate Milton Friedman was their speaker. In 1978, Pepperdine won its first NCAA championship in any sport when it won the NCAA championship in men's volleyball with a dramatic 15-12 victory over UCLA in the fifth, final, and deciding game. In 1985, they won it again. And in 1986, they won it again. 3 times in less than a decade. The men's volleyball team won the NCAA championship. On September 13th that year, Howard White was sworn in as the 5th president of Pepperdine University. In 1981, he made one of his most significant moves with the Louisiana Purchase of Pepperdine University, as it has been fondly called, when he made the decision to purchase 200 acres north of this campus that would actually lead over the mountain and raise this campus to a total of 819 acres. William Rehnquist came on November 17, 1979, to dedicate the Law Center. He's been a good friend. He was here again in August 1986 when the United States Senate was voting on whether or not he would be confirmed as the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. That vote went in his favor, even as he was lecturing on this campus. When the news was passed through the door, the dean of the law school wrote it out in a message and handed it up to Justice Rehnquist to let him know, congratulations, you've just been made Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. He found out on the Pepperdine campus. In 1982, Pepperdine hosted their great rivals, the University of San Francisco, in basketball. It did not appear that they had a chance against the larger and more powerful USF Dons, but in the second greatest game in the history of Firestone Fieldhouse, led by Boot Bond and Orlando Phillips and Dane Suttle, on January 15, 1982, in a dramatic overtime victory, Pepperdine prevailed 102-91. Those of us who were there shan't forget it for a long time. In 1984, the number one water polo team in America, the University of California at Irvine, came into Pepperdine undefeated and cocky, but got beat that day 11-10 in double overtime. In a game that was so dramatic that all the senior administrators came to attend the game and then posed with the wet players after the game in a moment of mass hysteria that we have captured on film and is in this book. The Nancy Reagan dinner on May the 1st, 1983, was a great moment in the history of the school. She came as First Lady to be honored with an honorary doctorate. The big tent was thrown up next to the pool. It was a grand occasion. 1984, the London program was launched. 1987, Florence Pepperdine was becoming international. Soon a program will be developed in the Far East. And perhaps one of the greatest events ever that seemed to go on forever, August 1st to 10th, 10 glorious days in the summer of 1984, the 23rd Olympiad came to Los Angeles, and Pepperdine played host to the water polo competition and saw the American team, led by Pepperdine players, fight their way into the championship game, come in second to Czechoslovakia, and walk off with the silver medal. The events have been fast and furious these last few years. February the 2nd, 1985, Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman on the Supreme Court, came to spend the day at Pepperdine and speak to the students. October the 21st, 1985, the inauguration of David Davenport as the sixth president of the university. March the 27th, 1987, Helen Pepperdine Day, when she came back to the campus, reliving her 50 years, and the students honored her. January the 18th, 1987, of this year, when the Charles B. Thornton Administrative Center was dedicated, the largest building on the campus. And when the U.S. News and World Report came out with their annual poll of American college presidents in the fall of 1985, the American college presidents ranked Pepperdine University number one in its category, which was a category called Comprehensive Universities West of the Mississippi River. Of all the universities that fit that classification, Pepperdine was ranked number one in the fall of 1985. When William S. Benowski gave his great address, The Spirit of Place, which launched this Malibu miracle on May the 23rd, 1970, he offered this great line: Mr. Pepperdine was a lifelong member of the Church of Christ, and we are especially grateful for our fraternal relationship with this religious group. Although we are completely independent and under no church board, these non-denominational congregations form our closest constituency. And unlike the pattern of most church-related colleges in our era of growth and expansion, we intend to strengthen, not loosen, these ties with our own brethren. But as we unashamedly put Christian values at the heart of the whole educational process, we will resist any sectarian spirit. We will do nothing to stifle full and open academic inquiry, nor shall we pose as an institution which knows all truth. What we affirm is that while our vision of truth is always limited, ultimate truth actually exists. We affirm that the university is undergirded by an objective moral order. We will continue to keep pace with change, but our main purpose in this place will be to discover what is not changing. And our central conviction has been, and is today, and will be, that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. And we will bring into life at this place a type of education which focuses personal attention upon each student as an individual. The central crisis in our time is a crisis in the quality of life for the individual. Man is steadily being dehumanized, and the process is nowhere more apparent than our own mechanized, impersonalized approach to education. It was Jesus' idea that one person is of greater worth than all the material world combined. In that spirit, we shall enroll each student as a sacred trust. There is, in our complex age, clearly a place for the multiversity with its research orientation, massive student body, and specialized faculty. But there has perhaps never been a greater need for the small, person-centered college. Throughout American history, such colleges have produced more than their proportionate share of outstanding leaders in science, politics, business, and religion. Surely there is something powerful about an academic atmosphere in which a professor knows the students personally and is personally known by the students, in which he is available to the students, not only as a lecturer, but as a person. And then he committed these lines at his closing. And so what we hope to build is much more than a beautiful campus. It will, as you can sense, be that. But if that is all we shall have accomplished, we shall have failed. What we hope to create here in these hills is a spirit of place, a place where minds will be opened, where lives will be changed, where lasting relationships will be formed. A college is, after all, something like a human being, in that both must have a soul of some kind. My deepest concern in this hour of dedication is for the soul of the college. I would like, in the final analysis, for our work to be judged on the basis of what we have believed and how we have put that faith into action. It is in this spirit that we hallow this ground and accept this challenge. These historic acres along the rim of the Malibu will, from this day, never again be the same. From this day forward, let it be known that in this place, quote, we look not at the things that are seen, but at the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are temporal, but the things that are unseen are eternal. The great words of the Apostle Paul in the Corinthian letter. A few years ago, the Newcomen Society honored Pepperdine University one night here in Los Angeles, and a man asked if he could attend. He didn't know anything about Pepperdine, but he wanted to attend because he said, I hope tonight in all of these speeches to find out what the magic formula is. He was an administrator in the University of California system. He came that night. He listened. And when it was over, his friend asked him, well, did you find the magic formula about Pepperdine University? He said, yes, I think I did. And this is it. You take a university of Christian faith. You add a dedication to private enterprise and a commitment to a better America. Then you ensure a quality program in the education of youth. He went on to say, with these three ingredients, there is no university in the United States with a greater potential than Pepperdine University. A few years ago, Dr. Isong Ibakate from Nigeria sat where you sit and graduated here with a BA, went home to Nigeria, where he was elevated in rank and importance, and today is the Nigerian ambassador to Sweden. He wrote back to us here a letter dated January 26, 1982, and I'd like to close with this. He wrote to say, Pepperdine University played a vital role in my life. This great institution offered me not only sound academic training, but a high quality of religious and moral training to strengthen my skills and initiative in the performance of duties incidental to my office. He went on to say, Pepperdineism, as he called it, and then he defined Pepperdineism. Pepperdineism is, therefore, my philosophy of life. Constant search for truth through sound education, research, and dedication of honest service, first to God, second to my nation, and thirdly to humanity. It's been a great 50 years, and if we will hang on to these founding principles, the greatest years are still to come. Thank you for listening to this historic address.